new year. Welcome to the first weekly podcast from Innovation Forum for 2019 with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is the usual news digest and some details of what Innovation Forum will be up to this year. Also, we have an interview I recorded at our Sustainable Landscapes Conference with Sophie Higman from ProForest, Maria Lavier-Pio from Cargill, and Natasha Shortsback from PepsiCo, where we unpicked what successful landscape-level collaboration looks like in the context of a fascinating case study in Indonesia. Plus, another chance to hear the most downloaded podcast of 2018 with Risha Bajpai from Gudira. Next up, though, is our regular review of what's happening in business and sustainability. ...2019 seems set to be a year where climate-related risks for business, its supply chains and its impact on communities will continue to dominate many agendas. Following on the heels of the news that emissions from the US spiked significantly during 2018 after 3 years of reductions, a new report this week from charity Christian Aid, titled Counting the Cost, A Year of Climate Breakdown, highlights the high price already of climate change. Headlines from the research are that extreme weather killed thousands around the world in 2018. And in terms of economics, the report identifies 10 individual events that cost more than $1 billion each, with four costing more than $7 billion. Among the weather events highlighted are droughts in Argentina, affecting soy and maize crops, floods in Kerala, India, forcing over a million people from their homes, the extreme summer in Japan, including flooding and Typhoon Jebi, droughts in South Africa, bringing Cape Town within weeks of a water day zero when supplies will be shut off to 75% of the city, and of course the wildfires in the US state of California, which have been the most destructive and deadly in the state's history. The report's writers stress that their intention is to demonstrate that climate change is not a future issue, but one that is at a tipping point now. And for sectors and businesses with climate risks, a key point is, of course, how their activities will be assessed and how authorities will hold them to account around the world. And in Indonesia, the Supreme Court has recently upheld a ruling against a palm oil company for negligence around forest fires, with a stiff $60 million fine and a requirement for rehabilitation of the land affected. The lawsuit in question was brought by Indonesia's Ministry of Environment and Forestry, and palm oil watchers argue that this could be a signal of a growing get-tough approach on forest destruction, and in particular, clearance by burning. Fires in Indonesia's forests reached a crisis point, of course, in 2015, when haze engulfed large parts of the nation, spreading to neighbouring countries as fires raged across over 26,000 square kilometres, much of which was drained peatlands. And some apparently better news has emerged, though, with some 24,000 square kilometres of peatlands having been restored in the 3 years since the Indonesian president launched a programme to prevent a repeat of the 2015 haze. At the same time, the number of forest fire hotspots has significantly dropped. While these are, of course, welcome developments, climate experts point out that the weather conditions have been more favourable in the intervening years. The real test will come with the developing El Niño, expected to peak later this year. El Niño years are typified by drier conditions in Southeast Asia, more conducive, of course, to greater forest fire risks. As a brief aside, in the latest issue of Science magazine, there is a fascinating paper entitled The Sound of a Tropical Forest on research into how the sounds of a forest can help to monitor animal biodiversity and hence conservation. Bioacoustics, the paper argues, is an emerging tool with great promise for studying biodiversity in tropical forests to complement and enhance other remote sensing techniques such as satellite monitoring. Satellites are also being used to monitor other supply chains, including recently in the Thailand seafood industry, which has come under significant scrutiny in recent years because of endemic forced labour and slavery in the country's fishing fleet. The European Union has had a threat in place since 2015 to ban imports from Thailand unless the country made progress to clean up the industry, tackling illegal and unregulated fishing in particular. The US government also highlighted the human rights abuses in the sector, and it seems that progress has been made. The EU has withdrawn its yellow card warning, citing efforts by the Thai authorities to crack down on abuses using modern techniques such as satellite monitoring, optical scanning, and more traceable electronic payments. Activists warn, however, that there are still gaps in the reforms and that there is a danger of complacency now that the EU has withdrawn its threatened ban. The Thai seafood sector has particular modern slavery and forced labour risks, as most of the 600,000 workers in the industry are vulnerable migrants. There's lots of new information, including ever-expanding panellist and expert participant lists for Innovation Forum's 2019 conference programme online. We're looking forward to our new and interactive events on the future for food, apparel and textile supply chains, modern slavery, business and human rights. Book by Friday 11th this week to save £400 on best price conference passes for Innovation Forum's opening event of its spring season on how business can tackle modern slavery, forced labour and human trafficking in London on the 2nd and 3rd of April. Join us and experts from IKEA, Next, Walmart, Hewlett-Packard Enterprises, ABN AMRO, Skanska and many more for 2 days of rigorous off-the-record debate and insight. Interview time now. A few weeks ago at Innovation Forum's Sustainable Landscapes Conference in London, I sat down with Sophie Higman from ProForest, Maria Lavier-Pio from Cargill and Natasha Schwarzbach from PepsiCo to talk about what successful collaboration looks like. And we've been talking about a specific case study in Indonesia around developing a landscape approach in the palm oil sector. So, Sophie, why don't you start us off by giving a quick introduction into how you got involved in working in Indonesia with PepsiCo and with Cargill?
So, a bit of background, we work with dozens of companies in the supply chain of different agricultural commodities, and particularly in oil palm. So we work with a lot of different actors at different stages of the supply chain of palm oil. And we've been working with a lot of companies to help them implement their commitments on no deforestation, no exploitation, no peat, and how that gets tracked back and driven back through the supply chain to the production areas on the ground. And we're very aware that many of the issues around implementing these commitments can't be dealt with through a single supply chain, through a single mill. And the issues are shared by many producers, many mills, many supply chains. So engaging with mills through the supply chain is a necessary part of making sure that this change, that deforestation is reduced, that exploitation is removed from supply chains, that's a necessary part of it to work through the supply chain, but it's not enough to affect change and have huge impact across a landscape. So we're looking at how we can involve actors at different stages of supply chains or agricultural commodities in landscape approaches, and how that can, in practice, you know, what does that mean on the ground? And how can we make sure that we have this kind of bigger impact? So we're looking at how to get a collaborative engagement across the landscape with a number of companies. In this particular case, we're involved with a group of 7 companies and with our partners, Diameter as well, and working through and with the local district government and local NGOs as part of the collaboration that we need to build. And we're at a very initial stage of this at the moment.
Sure. Yes, it is all very new. Can you just give a very quick definition of when a landscape approach is a landscape approach and when a jurisdictional approach is a jurisdictional approach? And this is the difference between the two.
Okay, so a landscape approach we would see as being something which is a geographical land area, an approach that's looking at it affecting change and involving stakeholders and working at scale in a geographical area. That might be defined by environmental or ecological boundaries. We would say a jurisdictional approach has that same kind of scale to it, but it's defined along political, subnational, jurisdictional boundaries, and very much focusing on the involvement of government within that as a key player, but also all the other stakeholders.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Marie, why don't you introduce the specific program that we've just been talking about and insight into why Cargill's got involved?
So we are a coalition of 7 companies, as Sophie explained, more specifically Unilever, PepsiCo, Danone, Nestlé, Musimasgar and Cargill are involved in a landscape approach with the support of our implementation partner, Core, Demeter and ProForest in the SIAC landscape. What we aim to do there is to develop a verified sustainable production area, focusing on developing solutions at scales to address common environmental and social issues, to pilot multi-stakeholder approach, to support and empower the local organization, building capacity, and finally, to develop solutions to improve farmer livelihoods. So we decided to work in the SIAC and Pelalawan landscapes. These are 2 regions that are close by from the Dumai port, which is a very important port in Indonesia and where we are sourcing a big quantity of oil from. 20% of the mill of the Rio region are actually located in these 2 landscapes, and many of these mills are considered high priority mills because they are located in a high risk area that might be peatland, protected forests that have been deforested, There are also a lot of independent smallholders, and there are also a lot of health and safety issues, and more specifically, labor issues that needs to be addressed. So we have an approach in three phases. The first phase in which we are at the moment, and that is started over the summer and will last until April 2019, consists of designing this intervention. So mapping the supply base, having a better understanding of the supply base, who are these stakeholders on the ground, what are the various initiatives, and develop together an agreement on what are going to be the Golden's objective of this project and how are we going to go about it. And I think it's good to mention that actually we do not want to start from scratch. We want to build on existing initiatives that are in the neighborhoods in the region. So to mention, we have like the SIAC Green District Initiative, the LTKL platform, the FOXB UNDP ISPO platform. There are a lot of private sector initiative and donor funded programs by WWF, by Packard Foundation, UNDP, in the Teso Nilo Park.
I mean, just to clarify, we're talking about an area that's in the northern Indonesian island of Sumatra, aren't we?
Yeah, good point. And so the SIAC and Pelalawan district are actually located in the center of Sumatra, Indonesia, in the Rio province.
Turning to you, Natasha, how does the work that Cargill's instigated, working partners including ProForest, how does that fit in with your own strategy and aims around your palm oil supply?
For PepsiCo, we take a very holistic, inclusive and collaborative approach to sustainable palm oil. We do have public commitments to source 100% RSPO certified by 2020, but we also have a global policy around our NDPE. And what we're looking to do is deliver our strategy for sustainable palm oil, which is around four pillars. And that involves transparency and engagement with stakeholders, how we actively participate with our suppliers. For us, we need to better understand the concerns and issues and opportunities in our supply base. And it's also around positive impact programs. So we are investing in landscape initiatives that support communities, development, conservation and smallholder inclusion. For us, we source from three countries, Mexico, Malaysia and Indonesia. If we look at our global supply, we source 40% from North Sumatra and Riau, so it's a very important area for us. But the program, one of the key components is that it involves a broad range of stakeholders. And we recognise that these systemic issues will require the entire value chain to come together and to be dedicated to effect change.
Our session demonstrated that there are these problems that are in place, and it's great that the companies are accepting that and saying, well, we're going to want to work to make things better. Sophie, turning back to you, what sort of restoration is going to be involved in this project down the line? I mean, that's something that has been front of mind at the moment, given all the recent reports we've had around what's required to stay at 1.5 degrees centigrade warming and everything else. So how do you want to do? We're obviously moving from mapping what the problems are, dealing with the problem mills, looking at where there's power being grown on peat, trying to solve that problem. But then when are we going to move on to restoration of peatlands, restoration of forests, do you think?
I think that very much depends on what the interventions are that are decided on by the group and by the wider stakeholder group in SIAC and Pelalawan. I think restoration may be part of the mix of interventions, but there's going to be a whole lot of different options looking all the way from supporting smallholders with better agricultural practices and different, you know, livelihood options, through to protection in national park areas, that there are lots of different possibilities there. At the moment, we're kind of thinking about costing these things out and looking at kind of what those options are. And restoration is likely to be one of those options for certain.
Sure.
I'm not going to commit area.
No, but I think the whole thing demonstrates the kind of challenge and the complexity that so many businesses have in their supply chains. And it also demonstrates that companies such as Cargill and PepsiCo are now clearly wanting to engage and deal with these issues. Is that something you're finding with other projects you're involved in?
Absolutely. Yes, I think we're finding more and more companies coming to us from different parts of the supply chain, asking how they can be involved in landscape approaches, asking what they can do, asking where they can work, and how to collaborate with other companies. And I think that's one of the things we're seeing a lot of, is different companies in supply chains very interested in collaborating with each other, as well as being involved in public-private collaboration.
Great. Well, Sophie, Maria, and Natasha, thanks very much for presenting a fascinating case study and for your support of the event.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We've been delighted at the listener response over the past few months to our podcast and interviews. Coming up now is another chance to hear the most standard interview of 2018, which I recorded with Goodera founder Risha Bajpai following Innovation Forum's Measurement and Return on Investment conference in London last year. So why don't you start us off by giving us a little bit of background about the work of Goodera?
So, you know, first of all, we had a great conversation during the sustainability event in London. Some great insights came out of those conversations. Just to give you a little bit of background as to what we do at Goodera, our mission as a company is to power the world of good, which means we are trying to bring in technology in the space of doing good, you know, be it the corporates, foundations, individuals. We enable them by using technology to do good. We provide them with a platform which helps them easily manage their CSR and sustainability performance in a very engaging manner, and also which helps them with last mile impact, with, you know, last mile beneficiary tracking in real time. So we are building technology for all the stakeholders in this ecosystem, which not only includes the corporates, foundations, but also the not-for-profits and individuals.
So what exactly does that mean then? What sort of technology do you offer specifically?
So basically, you know, what our platform does is it helps a corporate to manage their entire CSR life cycle or sustainability life cycle. When I say that, if a corporate wants to do a development project or a sustainability project, they can float in RFPs using a platform. They can get responses from, you know, the relevant partners, be it suppliers, be it not-for-profits, and they can score them, evaluate them on our platform. Once the evaluation is done, they can do contracts online, digitally get them signed. And once the contracts are done, we actually move into the core of what we do in terms of measuring impact. The key performance indicators, which are configured onto the system as per various frameworks. It could be LBG, it could be LFA framework. You know, the key performance indicators of a particular project are configured onto the platform. And then the partner who's implementing these initiatives on the ground, you know, updates their performance against those indicators on a real-time basis from ground zero through our mobile app, which is available in multiple languages, and it is also available offline just in case there's no Wi-Fi. And for the donor or for the corporate who's started this or who's funding this initiative can get real-time updates and can see health of the project as well as the progress of the project. And then they can report it out to various investors, can report it out as per various frameworks like GRI, CDP, DJSI, so on and so forth. So, you know, just to add a little bit, we currently work with about 200 plus corporates across 60 countries. So that's the scale at which we are managing this entire ecosystem using our technology platform.
That sounds fascinating. So let's think a little bit about the work you're doing with your clients. How are the challenges that your clients are facing engaging on their impact of their sustainability programs? How are these challenges changing?
Initially, when without Goodera, you know, the clients would be managing everything manually through emails or through Excel sheets or people sending them updates on WhatsApp or just giving them a quarterly report, which is just a jazzy looking report with good language written in it, but nothing which can help them take data-driven decisions and which is more real-time or more recent information through which people could act. But with us coming into play, the information that comes in becomes more handy, becomes more real-time, becomes more accurate. So, you know, they are able to take decisions because the sustainability teams any which ways are lean teams, right? So I feel strongly that their time should be invested in actually analyzing the data and taking decisions from it, making changes in their strategy or enhancing the strategy rather than just crunching numbers or following up with partners and things like that, right? So with us coming into picture, things are changing wherein the teams are becoming more efficient. They have better handle on the data so that they can take data-driven decisions and communicate better stories. You know, just to give you an example, a sales and marketing team, any organization
would have so much of data which can give them the kind of work that they're doing, which can give them detailed analysis. Imagine if the same kind of data is available to the sustainability and CSR teams, they can do such great data-driven impact stories. So that's how things are changing, with more data coming in, with more real-time and robust and accurate data coming in, which helps the sustainability teams do better at their work.
What are the key factors then that companies must address using your technology or using similar tools must address to be able to effectively track and monitor their impact and performance?
A couple of things which are really important for the success of bringing in technology. Obviously, technology is a catalyst. It's not the end output, right? So first and foremost, it is important for the companies to understand that the sustainability projects or the CSR projects first need to be understood in detail, and in terms of the key performance indicators should be decided upfront and very objectively. These initiatives just shouldn't be done because the companies want to look good, but because the companies really want to do work which aligns with the principles of sustainability and development. And also at the same time, the partners that are there who are helping them implement those initiatives on the ground, the corporates should actually enable their capacity building as well so that they become more technology savvy and they thereby become more efficient because if they use technology. Corporates should look at their role as building that entire ecosystem rather than just keeping at a program level transaction. So corporates should actually take the role of a higher responsible citizen to drive betterment in this entire ecosystem and thereby enabling better tracking and monitoring of impact and performance of sustainability and CSR initiatives.
And I guess what your solutions like it, just provide efficiency for corporate responsibility teams so that, as you say, they can spend more time thinking about strategy and less time worrying about collecting data or bringing data together and making it on a common platform. What are the trends you're seeing in how companies use technology then?
The trends that I'm seeing is that companies, because to be very frank, sustainability or the corporate responsibility function is the last bastion in the corporate which is yet to be automated. I mean, every function from sales to marketing to HR to finance have technology systems which act as a great enabler. So now technology has started coming in the sustainability and the corporate responsibility function, which is a great positive for this sector. It is actually going to save so much work hours of people, and they could invest their time in better work. As well as people will be able to see more objective data, more objective insights through which they could drive their projects better. To be very frank, Ian, running a sustainability or a corporate responsibility function is not easy. So when you're getting significant amount of monies to invest in such projects, they should very well be run like business units, you know. Imagine that you're a VC, you're a venture capitalist, and you're investing in startups. A sustainability or corporate responsibility professional who's leading a function should start looking at, you know, that I'm a VC and I'm investing in a startup, which could be a sustainability initiative. So everywhere, all the trends follow a bell curve. So, you know, there are companies who've adopted things proactively and who are ahead of the curve and, you know, have started looking at the sustainability initiatives, expecting good outcomes. The outcomes may not be tangible, but they could be from a social perspective or an environment perspective. That's perfectly fine. But people have started putting in that cap and started looking at it from a social return on investment perspective, which is a good approach. So that is a trend which I'm seeing. I'm hopeful that this trend grows year on year and the sustainability professionals are able to prove and showcase with the use of technology that how sustainability performance is actually helping the business in its bottom line. When this connect is clearly established, I don't think that there will be any kind of resistance from anyone with regards to these initiatives. So those are some of the trends that I'm seeing, and I'm very positive of the future. With Larry Fink's letter coming in, I'm sure the talks at the board levels have already started, you know, and they've started giving more impetus and more importance to their environmental sustainability or governance performance across.
Okay, well, thank you. And I think you're absolutely right that using the language of business is so important for every business functioning, particularly for sustainability functions, and integrating that into the rest of the business and using common language, common metrics is going to be vital for the future of corporate sustainability projects and demonstrating how they do provide proper economic benefit for each company. Risha from Gudira, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Ian. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Don't forget to sign up this week for best price passes for the Business and Modern Slavery Conference in London this coming 2nd and 3rd of April. But that's it for now. Happy New Year once again for all of us at Innovation Forum. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.